In what would normally be the height of the summer season for Corpus Christi, new restrictions go into effect, but do they go far enough? That and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Our conversation with the mayor of Corpus Christi as regional ICU bed space reaches single-digit levels. Also, an update on the situation in Dallas. A surprising backyard trend during the pandemic and why it has some Texans crying foul over the mesh of rules. Another profile in one of the key races during primary runoff season, plus a whole lot more. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time, and we'll get underway right after this. It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown, and in the spotlight on this first day of July, a place that holds the title of fifth largest port in the U.S. It is Texas's eighth largest city, home to an important naval air station with the biggest helicopter repair facility in the world. It's the county seat of Nueces, and now it is under new orders from the governor. In case you haven't guessed, we're talking about Corpus Christi, what the tourist brochures describe as the sparkling city by the sea. Needless to say, tourism right now isn't what it would normally be this time of year, but that's not the city's biggest problem. Corpus Christi and Nueces County face a health crisis mirroring those in some of the biggest metro areas in the state. On Tuesday morning, Governor Greg Abbott extended a prohibition on elective surgeries and other procedures in four more Texas counties, all in South Texas: Cameron, Hidalgo, Webb, and Nueces counties, expanding his orders from last week covering the four biggest metro counties in Texas: Bexar, Dallas, Harris, and Travis counties. The idea is to preserve hospital beds and health care resources. Nearly every day since June 1st, COVID hospitalization rates and numbers have been rising statewide, but Nueces and the other three counties added yesterday are the hardest hit in South Texas. Under the governor's current orders, medical procedures required for a serious medical condition or to preserve life can still take place at the discretion of a patient's physician. But the situation is so critical in Nueces that as of the start of this week, only 9 ICU beds were reported available across the whole of the Coastal Bend Trauma Service region. Joe McComb is mayor of Corpus Christi, and he joins us now. Mayor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
I mentioned that there's a shortage of hospital beds in the Coastal Bend Trauma Service region, and that number, just 9 left, is got to be awfully scary to you. What is the situation in Corpus as you have heard it last?
Well, we are getting close to capacity. I think we've still got some, but the thing that's concerning the majority of the hospitals right now is that these healthcare workers, I mean, you know, they've been going for months now 24/7, and some of them are just getting worn out physically. So, and some of them have you know, contracted the COVID. So we're running a little short on nurses and people to work in the hospitals, and that may be a contributing factor as to how many folks they can only take in so many that they can service. So capacity-wise, I think we're all right, and if we can get a handle on this, they can get in and get out quickly, but we're watching that very closely. We're in close contact with all hospitals here in town and their administrators. We're doing the best we can with what we have. It just exploded on us.
You mentioned your resources stretched there. As I understand it, the state is sending some kind of assistance to hospitals in Corpus. Have you heard any details on that?
We're working with our state legislators and with emergency management with the state to try to find us additional testing kits and other materials that we need to address. And the state has really been very responsive. Part of it is the supply chain, and of course, we've got an explosion, but if you look at San Antonio and Houston, some of those, I mean, they're really, you know, it's just going crazy there too. So the supply chain has got a demand on it that it's having a hard time keeping up with. So they're doing as best they can, trying to allocate resources to the people that need it the most, the quickest. But yes, every day is in communication with the state to see what available resources there are. And, and putting a request in for whatever we can get.
Now, you mentioned the concern about beach tourism, the reopening, the spread there. You got a busy 4th of July weekend coming up. What's the city planning on doing to control the spread of COVID during this holiday weekend?
Well, we're going to go back, and the judge announced yesterday that beginning July the 3rd at 6 a.m., that the beaches, you can't have vehicular traffic on the beaches. We're going to close the beaches to vehicular traffic. You can still get on there if you're in a condominium or you live out on the island or you park on one of the parking lots off of the highway, and then you can walk to the beach. It's the lure of the beach that's the problem. It's not the beach. I mean, all the medical professionals say, you know, sunshine and open spaces and breezes are wonderful, and it is. But the problem is, you know, that we have is that when the sun goes down, you get these 100,000 people that have come in to go to the beaches.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're in the restaurants, they're in the grocery stores, they're in our hardware stores, you know, wanting to have a good time. And I think that's where the transmission's taking place.
Mayor, forgive me for interrupting, but we just have a couple of seconds. I want to ask, if it were up to you, if you had the power under Governor Greg Abbott's executive orders, would you issue a stay-at-home order again for the city of Corpus Christi right now?
Well, we're encouraging people to. I don't know that ordering it is. You know, ordering it is, anytime you order something, you've got to be able to enforce it, and that's a problem. Just like when in hurricane evacuation, you tell people to evacuate, but you can't go out there and drag them out of their house if they don't want to go. But wear the mask, you know, continue to do the hygiene things, wash your hands, don't put your, you know, touch your face, and for goodness sakes, if you're sick, stay away from healthy people, and if you're healthy, stay away from sick people. But that's the way to do it, I think. Mandating it, I'm not sure, is the answer. It sounds real impressive, but getting people to comply and then trying to enforce it, I think, is just an exercise in futility, if you want my opinion.
Mayor Joe McComb, Mayor of Corpus Christi, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard, Mayor.
Well, thank you for having me. Have a good day.
As far as elections rank in excitement, a primary runoff may not at first blush seem very important, but its results can indicate which wing of a party is gaining momentum. So as Texans go to the polls in early voting for the July 14th runoffs, we're taking a look at some of the most high-profile races on the ballot. Texas's 10th congressional district stretches from Houston to Austin, and for more than a decade, that district was solidly Republican. But in 2018, incumbent Congressman Michael McCaul had the closest race of his career. As Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports, two Democrats are now fighting for the chance to take on McCaul in November.
In 2018, Mike Siegel lost to McCaul by fewer than 5 percentage points. In the Progressive Democrats' second run for the seat, he's focusing on Medicare for all.
I think it's fair to analogize this COVID-19 pandemic to a war, and definitely in terms of lives lost, but also the impact on the economy.
Siegel says government intervention is critical at this moment.
And to me, the example of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in terms of building this new deal, the Works Progress Administration, using the power of the federal purse to basically put people to work, create new jobs and new industries, and bring the country out of an economic crisis.
Siegel's Democratic primary runoff opponent, Dr. Pritesh Gandhi, is generally viewed as the moderate in the race. Gandhi favors universal health care as well, if a more incremental approach, informed largely by his work in an Austin-based community health center.
Unequivocally, health is a human right, and that's how I view that. I viewed it from that perspective and that lens my entire life. It is an inherent right available to all children and all adults in every part of our world.
Right now, their runoff is too close to call, says Victoria DeFrancesco Soto of the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT Austin. But she points to the primary's first round, where the combined moderate vote, including defeated moderate Shannon Hutchison, outweighed that of progressive Mike Siegel.
Siegel got 44%, Gandhi got 33%, Hutchison got in the 20s.
Whoever wins the Democratic primary will face 8-term Republican incumbent Michael McCaul. On health care, McCaul has repeatedly voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. His main focus this election is foreign affairs, specifically his work as head of the House GOP's China Task Force. McCall holds Beijing responsible for the spread of coronavirus from a local threat to a global pandemic.
I think it's important to be focused on what Congress needs to do right now to help the American people. It's also a time to provide oversight on the response efforts themselves, but it's also important to look at the cause. How did this happen, and how can we stop it from ever happening again?
The 10th Congressional District is anchored by large metro areas on each side, with a wide swath of rural counties in between.
So it's just going to come down to really that more rural area in between Austin and Houston to see who wins that battle.
Billy Monroe teaches political science at Prairie View A&M University.
And whoever wins that's going to win the election.
Monroe says that middle area is still majority white and male, giving McCall the edge. But the LBJ school's Victoria DeFrancesco Soto argues even there, some Republicans are on the fence because of dissatisfaction with President Trump and with Governor Abbott's handling of the pandemic.
So the Republican Party that Texas knew and supported has changed. And I think that that's also moving the moderate Republicans and the independents and even some of those swing moderate Democrats into more of that Democratic category.
Most political observers, though, still rank the race as leaning or likely Republican. If the Democratic candidate does pull off an upset in November, it'll be a sign Texas politics have dramatically shifted. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
What's the talk of Texas on this Wednesday? Let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick raising eyebrows with his latest appearance on Fox News. Last night, the light gov attacked the nation's top infectious disease doctor, Anthony Fauci, saying, quote, he doesn't know what he's talking about, and added that Texas hadn't skipped over anything in its reopening of the state. Quote, the only thing I'm skipping over is listening to him, close quote, according there to the lieutenant governor. As you might expect, his remarks generating a lot of comments on our Facebook page there. Justin Klumpener says, we're not listening to our country's leading experts on infectious diseases during a pandemic? No wonder Texas is being held up as a cautionary tale nationally when we're regularly being mentioned alongside Florida. It's not a good look. And Tom Getty calls it another amateur trying to out-expert the experts and adds, it's sad because some people pay attention to this man. Meanwhile, Karen Money Sneed notes that Patrick previously said in a past Fox appearance that elderly Americans should be prepared to sacrifice themselves to aid and abet the reopening of the American economy. Obviously, some controversial comments from Dan Patrick there. I'll be back with more later in the show, David.
Hey, Texas, we'd love to hear from you. What's on your news radar? Reach out to us, won't you? Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he's going to be joining us again in about 35 minutes or so with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Business and Your Money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. The oil and gas industry has become more active in the Permian Basin in recent years, and West Texas residents have complained of noxious smells and increased air pollution. In response, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality launched two air monitoring surveys back in December and again in February, and the results are now public. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh has the details.
The survey teams spent 10 total days in the Permian Basin. They focused on publicly accessible and populated areas near industrial sites. The surveys measured air pollutants like sulfur dioxide and the more poisonous gas, hydrogen sulfide. The legal limit of hydrogen sulfide in Texas is an average of 80 parts per billion over 30 minutes. According to TCEQ measurements, that limit was exceeded in several different places on multiple days, in the worst instance, by 500%, when the 30-minute average was 400 parts per billion. That level of the gas isn't enough to cause immediate serious health concerns, but it can do damage in the long term, says Afamia El-Nakat, a doctor of environmental toxicology at University of Texas San Antonio.
Well, in terms of long-term exposure, we look at it the same way we look at other respiratory irritants long-term. And that is basically asthmatic people will be impacted. You become less tolerant to other irritants.
The TCEQ Midland office is investigating several facilities, and the agency plans to install permanent monitoring stations in the area. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in the Texas Hill Country.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Another trend during the coronavirus pandemic, raising backyard chickens. In the first few weeks of the coronavirus lockdown, hatcheries across Texas reported up to a 200% increase in chicken sales. But in some cities, there are still laws that prevent people from exceeding a certain number of chickens or from raising them at all. Texas Standard intern Sarah Gabrielli has more.
Back in April, Kay Dreyer Hill started raising chickens in her backyard. It seemed like the right time.
We thought it would be a good distraction for my 9-year-old who was missing school and being isolated from friends and such. So my husband actually used part of his stimulus check to get the materials to buy the coop and get the chickens and everything.
Altogether, it cost about $600 for their 3 hens, Goldie, Biscuit, and Olivia, and for the supplies her husband Alfonso used to build a coop, waterers, feeders, and fences. The couple lives in Pflugerville, just outside Austin, so Alfonso had to be careful not to violate any of the local ordinances.
They have really generic rules that just say they have to be restrained and not cause a noise or odor nuisance. And we also, just to be safe, just made sure that our coop was a good distance from all our neighbors.
Compared to other parts of Texas, these restrictions are pretty easy. In El Paso, all chicken owners need a city permit. Fort Worth residents cannot keep any fowl within 50 feet of another residence. And in Dallas, it's illegal for anyone to own a rooster at all. During last year's legislative session, Texas State Representative James White filed a bill to end some of these restrictions. The bill would have allowed most Texans to own at least 6 chickens.
As this was brought to me, it was people wanting to have that level of dignity and self-worth and self-reliance, that they could participate actively in growing, nurturing, and providing for themselves and their families a fresh food source.
The bill did not pass, but according to White, these individual rights are especially important right now.
I'm seeing these limits on the number of egg cartons you can purchase, the number of jugs of milk that you can purchase. And that's why you're having more people wanting to step up and say, I want more control of my food source.
Texas's largest chicken seller, Ideal Poultry, reported a 50% increase in both livestock and supply sales during the pandemic. And at Callahan's General Store in Austin, adult hen sales tripled in the first 2 weeks of COVID-19 restrictions.
We were seeing customers coming in from as far west as Johnson City to come in and buy birds from us. As far south as San Antonio, as far east as Houston, and as far north as Waco.
This is Callahan's president and CEO, Charlie Wilson.
Each community has different restrictions that are applicable in different ways. Some are much more lax and some are more restrictive. Some have the noise ordinance, which affects your ability to raise roosters. Some don't.
That's the biggest issue for customers who are local to Austin. Residents cannot own any animals that, quote, make frequent or long continued noise.
While it's a very hen-friendly environment, if you have a rooster, you certainly can raise it, but it better not make a lot of noise because then it runs into problems with the noise ordinance for pets in the city of Austin.
Wilson also attributes the spike in chicken sales to supply shortages and chaos in grocery stores.
I think people also sense that they didn't know how long this might last, and in order to have a fresh daily source of and routine source of eggs, that this might be a good way for them to go about getting it.
For Kay Dreyer Hill, her new supply of 2 eggs per day is just an added bonus. The chickens are a source of entertainment for the whole family.
My husband, it gave him a project to do while we were all at home on lockdown. The kids, it gave them a great distraction because they make great pets, and my daughter's learning a lot about them. The eggs are a benefit too, but we didn't do it solely for the eggs. It was more just for the whole project, the whole experience.
With renewed interest in raising chickens, Representative White plans to refile his bill this legislative session. I'm Sarah Gabrielli for the Texas Standard.
Some other news items we're watching. Earlier today, the Texas Juvenile Justice Department announced it will begin mass testing at its 5 secure lockups. The Texas Tribune reports testing will cover 700 young detainees and 1,700 employees. This after 17 young people tested positive for the coronavirus inside state-run juvenile lockup facilities. TJJD says it will use the same oral tests that have been used to conduct more than 100,000 tests on adult prisoners by the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. In other news, Gulf Greyhound Park is shutting down after nearly 30 years in operation. The Galveston County Daily News reporting that the owners of the Texas dog racing track cite waning public interest in dog racing as the reason for closing. Greyhound racing in the U.S. has been on the decline in recent years. It's now illegal in 41 states. Texas was one of the last few states actively holding greyhound races, and Gulf Greyhound Park was the only one doing so on a regular basis. Our roundup of news from across the Lone Star State, the Texas Roundup, is just around the corner. And after that, we're going to be checking in with one of the top health officials in Dallas as hospital bed capacity to deal with COVID cases reaches new levels. What happens if the city approaches full capacity? Also, a claim that in Hays County, south and west of the Texas capital city, there's been an 845% increase in COVID cases in less than a month. All that and a whole lot more as the Standard continues on this Wednesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. State prisons in Texas begin accepting inmates from county jails today for the first time in nearly 3 months. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice halted intake in an effort to reduce the spread of the coronavirus in its facilities. Spokesperson Jeremy Diesel says the agency is taking a number of precautions as it restarts the process.
It will be very limited to just 250 offenders a week coming in statewide from various counties. We'll be starting with counties that don't show any evidence of COVID-19 within their county jail systems.
The intake process for all county jail inmates will take place at the Garza West Unit in Beeville, where they will undergo a 14-day quarantine. Since the pandemic began, more than 8,200 Texas prison inmates have tested positive for COVID-19. The Texas Commission on Law Enforcement will ask police departments to resubmit data on traffic stops. The move comes after the Houston Chronicle found the state agency failed to request information on the race of motorists that police officers searched, which is required by the Sandra Bland Act. Experts on racial profiling say a key way to determine if police officers are treating Black, Hispanic, and white drivers differently is to collect data on searches conducted during traffic stops. One of the experts is Tarleton State University criminal justice professor Alex Del Carmen.
We think that the searches is where the meat and potatoes of it all is, and that's why Sandra Bland became such a relevant and important piece of legislative component, because of the fact that we thought that Sandra Bland would allow us to analyze in a meaningful way the outcome of these searches.
The Sandra Bland Act is named for a 28-year-old black woman who died in a county jail in Texas after a white state trooper arrested her during a minor traffic stop. The Texas Workforce Commission is pausing plans to require people to search for a new job to get unemployment benefits. KUT's Becky Fogel has more.
The TWC was planning to reinstate the policy on Monday. This is the second time the state agency has put the federal requirement on hold during the pandemic. It first waived the policy in mid-March amid the widespread shutdown of the economy.
Becky Fogel reporting. And the Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath says the state of Texas assessments of academic readiness or STAR exams will resume during the upcoming school year. He updated the State Board of Education Tuesday.
We do need to know where our kids are. This is the reason that we have been diagnosing student proficiency for the last 30 years.
The governor previously suspended STAR tests in March due to the pandemic. I'm Joseph Leahy.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Over the past month, hospitalizations from COVID-19 have soared in Texas, so much so that Governor Abbott retracted some of his orders to reopen the state, reclosing bars, scaling back restaurant capacity, and halting elective surgeries in certain urban counties, as we were talking about earlier in this broadcast. The idea is to keep hospitals from being overwhelmed by COVID patients so that everyone who needs treatment can get it. Here to tell us more about how that's going in Dallas County is Dr. Philip Huang. He's director of the Dallas County Health and Human Services Department. Dr. Huang, welcome to The Standard.
Thank you.
So give us an update on the current status of hospital capacity there. What is it that Dallas hospitals need most right now?
So, you know, right now we are seeing record numbers of hospitalizations for confirmed COVID cases. Also, I think, you know, very near some of our highest numbers for ICU hospitalizations, some of the highest numbers for new admissions. And so, our current occupancy rate, bed occupancy rate is about, we're closer to 70%, 67-70%. ICU bed occupancy is around 70%. The hospitals have been preparing for much more surge capacity, but if we continue to see the rates of increase that we've been seeing, then we're really in a very critical situation.
So I have a good sense in my mind about bed space, but what about things like ventilators, testing equipment, personal protective equipment, and for that matter, personnel?
You know, right now our ventilator usage rate is about 46%. I think, you know, personnel is one of the things that is going to be a critical need. I think that, you know, we are getting reports also that, you know, many hospital personnel are becoming infected with COVID-19 also. So that affects that workforce capacity.
I have heard and seen reports, especially going back to, I guess it would have been late March and April, in which convention centers and other facilities were being outfitted as a kind of makeshift hospital space. Is that a possibility? Can you actually treat people under such circumstances?
You know, the K. Bailey Hutchison Convention Center was set up for that. It's still as a backup. But what we've learned now since, you know, from some of the experience in some of the other cities, as well as, you know, looking at our own situation, it's not, those aren't the settings where you really want to have ICU beds and hospitalized patients. What we've really come to see is we would prefer to use the manpower that might be available, that was originally made available to stand up those facilities. But we'd rather then take that manpower and putting them into our existing hospitals and support that. That would be our first preference on how to then further sort of provide additional support.
How would you assess the support that your department has received from state and federal authorities?
You know, we've been working certainly very closely with state and federal partners. You know, some of our testing sites have been jointly also with the city, county, and state. But, you know, I think that we're all facing some of the same challenges. Still, there's still issues with getting adequate, you know, testing in a timely manner and the reagents and getting that in place, as well as just, you know, so many different things that are still challenges for us with this.
If you had the ear of the governor, anything that you would say to him right now?
You know, I know that our county judge has made some recommendations. You know, we really are looking. One of the things, the universal masking has become, you know, I think there's more evidence, more scientific evidence and experience from other countries that if we could really achieve universal masking, that would be one piece that could help us safely open up the economy if we could really get everyone to do that. It's not a political thing. It's really a public health thing. And I think that's a pretty reasonable trade-off, that if we can get people to do that and protect, you know, their families and others, if everyone does it, then it protects everyone. And that may be is a very important thing. I think that, you know, we're recommending that we really need to sort of backtrack a little bit for like probably 30 days and slow this spread down. We've been successful. We know what works. I think we need to back up a little bit and get this back under control.
Dr. Philip Huang is the director of the Dallas County Health and Human Services Department. Dr. Huang, thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Among small businesses struggling during the coronavirus pandemic, nail salons. They're popular in Texas. In fact, Dallas and Harris counties rank among the top 10 nationwide in terms of having the most nail salon workers. The owners are often women and Vietnamese American. And as KERA's Elizabeth Myong reports, as salons reopen, owners are facing new challenges.
A worker spraying down Maud Nail Lounge with disinfectant. It's another task to add to the list since reopening in May. Co-owner Mai Duan is happy her doors are open, but the good news has been overshadowed by the overwhelming responsibility.
It has been a huge challenge trying to reopen and following all CDC guidelines has been a setback as well.
Duan's among women of color being financially challenged by the pandemic, facing higher rates of job loss and difficulty securing federal support. Seba Wahid is research director for the UCLA Labor Center. She says the nail industry is particularly vulnerable.
They're mothers and daughters, they're immigrant women, and they depend on this livelihood. And for basically the salons to have shut down as quickly as they did, most of these workers didn't have the recourse.
Duan turned to COVID-19 related bank and federal loans, but faced obstacles. She spent hours combing through bills and bank records, and even took part in a driveway strategy session with other nail salon owners. They spread 6 feet apart in lawn chairs, pulling out laptops and talking through applications. Still, it took Duan a month to get a Paycheck Protection Program loan after being denied and reapplying.
So it did take us a long time to understand it. You have to be extremely accurate. So it's not like you can just take an estimate.
Organizations like the Vietnamese American Community of Dallas are helping out. Tiffany Hong is the nonprofit's vice president of internal affairs. She says her group is providing translation services and news updates to members.
They don't know how they can ask for help. And that's where we are here.
The Vietnamese American community's close-knit network has helped them thrive in the U.S. nail salon business since the beginning. A group of women known as the First 20 were introduced to the nail industry by actress Tippi Hedren in 1975.
When the Vietnamese people come in, they work like family work, so they open their own shop.
That was Huan Lei, one of the First 20 featured in the documentary Nailed It. But the wave of xenophobia and racism against them was strong. Even now, during the pandemic, Vietnamese Americans don't have to look far to find examples of stigma.
This whole thing started in the state of California, the first community spread, in a nail salon.
That's California Governor Gavin Newsom in May. He faced backlash, but failed to provide evidence when questioned. A nail industry group threatened legal action. The coronavirus is highlighting the industry's vulnerability to biased attacks, but also labor and safety issues. Wahid says the low-wage system is now unsustainable.
What the big shadow over all of this is that it was a low-wage, low-service sector, meaning people generally were paying, you know, very little for the kind of service that they were getting, which transferred to lower profit margins.
Across the country, many owners are mourning the loss of their salons, and with them, a small slice of American history. Duan says it'll take a year for her salon to recover.
You know, April and May was the busiest month for us last year. And now going back into it, I mean, we're not the same.
The uncertainty makes Duan wonder if her salon will ever be the same again. I'm Elizabeth Mayong in Dallas.
It was first adopted more than 120 years ago, Mississippi's official state flag, which incorporates the Confederate battle cross. After years of demands for its removal, yesterday, Mississippi's governor signed into law a bill to redesign the flag. A new flag will be put to a popular vote in November. Closer to home, Dallas has taken down its largest Confederate monument in Pioneer Park. But as commentator W.F. Strong notes, there's a Confederate monument in bits and pieces spanning miles of Texas and beyond.
On July 29, 1925, a full 60 years after the American Civil War, Miss Decca Lamar West of Waco, Texas, wrote a strongly worded letter to Chief Thomas H. McDonald, the head of what was then the Federal Bureau of Public Roads. Miss West was an influential member of the United Daughters of the Confederacy who was lobbying for a coast-to-coast highway to honor the former president of the Confederate States. After all, President Abraham Lincoln had a highway already that stretched from New York City to San Francisco. Miss Decca Lamar West wrote, "The Jefferson Davis Highway directors feel that nothing could tend to the greater unity and understanding of the people than that two transcontinental highways should be named for the two great leaders of the critical period of American history." The honorary highway of which Decca wrote was almost fully realized. Today, the Jefferson Davis Memorial Highway still exists, but only in bits and pieces from Virginia to California. You'll find United Daughters of Confederacy markers along highways in Georgia and Louisiana and Arizona, but New Mexico had them all removed from along I-10 2 years ago. Texas also still has some markers. You can see them along U.S. 90 and 290 and I-35 and along Highways 59 and 77 south toward the border. Others have been removed, including those in San Antonio and San Marcos. Brownsville just removed its marker after a contentious debate. The marker originally placed on Palm Boulevard by the United Daughters of the Confederacy in 1927 was later moved to a city park after the state passed on certifying that memorial route. It was a simple large boulder with a plaque praising Jefferson Davis. Some wanted the boulder removed altogether because it honored Davis, who was a traitor to the U.S. Others felt that removing it would be an attempt to erase history. My contention is that the monument itself tried to erase history. It was one of at least 250 markers placed along U.S. roadways, which tried to rebrand Jefferson Davis to make the enslaver equal to the emancipator. The plaque on the boulder in Brownsville was stone-cold propaganda. The plaque identifies Davis as president of the CSA. The word Confederacy is not spelled out there. Were they hiding the word from Davis's resume? He is lauded as a United States soldier and senator. It says he resigned as senator, but it omits the fact that he resigned to create a new country where slavery would be forever legal. Finally, he is declared a martyr. But a martyr for what? Hundreds of thousands died for his cause, but he didn't. President Ulysses S. Grant believed that the contentiousness that resulted from the Civil War would, in time, pass. In 1885, in his famous memoirs, he wrote, "As time passes, people, even of the South, will begin to wonder how it was possible that their ancestors ever fought for or justified institutions which acknowledged the right of property in man." And yet, all these years later, these arguments over monuments persist. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, RGV. You can check out more of his stories from Texas at texasstandard.org, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
You're tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. According to a tweet by Congressman Lloyd Doggett, Hays County in Central Texas has seen an 845% increase in COVID-19 cases since June 7th. Is that a fact? Madeline Meckelberg will have the answer. She's with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is Lloyd Doggett's full claim here, and when did he make it?
So Congressman Doggett said this in a series of tweets he shared last week talking about the coronavirus in Central Texas, which includes his congressional district. And for some backdrop here, he shared this during a time where we're seeing coronavirus infections on the rise in Texas, hospitalizations related to COVID-19 rising. But some areas in the state are experiencing this more acutely than others. And right. What he was doing here was highlighting Hays County, which sits to the south side of Austin. And his June 21st tweet said, and I'm quoting, "Hays County is one of the only places in Texas with more trouble, an incredible 845% increase in cases since June 7th.
So Hays County is sort of south and west of Travis County, which is home county to the city of Austin. And it's considerably more rural. That's one of the reasons Doggett's talking about it here, right?
That's exactly right. And looking at it in comparison to Travis County, which has Austin inside of it, you can really see the issue here. There have been several days recently where Hays County reported more active coronavirus cases on a given day than Austin's Travis County. And Travis County's population is 5 times that of Hays County. So there's obviously an issue here. What we're checking is the math.
Well, wait a minute. Why might you see such a dramatic increase in Hays County? Why would this county get more cases than so many others?
So to answer that question, I'm going to rewind us a bit back to April and May, when we had local and statewide stay-at-home orders in place. People weren't going to work. They were staying at home the best that they could. And during that time, cases in Hays County on a daily basis, there were anywhere from 0 to 10 new COVID-19 cases on a given day. Right. But in late April and May, as Texas leaders started to reopen certain segments of the state's economy, the county started to see more cases every day. They were ranging from 20 to 50 new cases a day. But by June, the county was reporting between 100 to 200 new cases a day of COVID-19, up from 0 to 10 back in April. And the county told me that they've been using contact tracing on these cases to try and identify how it's being transmitted throughout their community. Uh-huh.
Right.
And what they told me is that this rapid increase has coincided with activities like working, going to restaurants, activities like floating the river in San Marcos, and attending large public gatherings like these social justice protests that we're seeing, Memorial Day events, Mother's Day events. So they've directly tied this increase to activities resulting from reopening the state.
Do the numbers check out? I mean, once you actually put in the numbers and do the percentage comparisons, does it add up?
So Doggett's office told me that his figure came from a local news report here in Austin that looked at the increase in the 14-day average of new daily cases from June 7th to June 21st. Mm-hmm. And in that context, his figure is accurate. But what's important here is that he needs to clarify that in his remark, because if he's just talking about the number of cases, those are different figures that we're looking at here. Typically, when we're trying to measure the increase of the impact of this virus, the number of new positive cases, you're going to see people talking about a 7-day average, because that helps to paint a more accurate picture of change over time, because it reduces mm-hmm. the impact of daily spikes or dips in the number of cases. So this 14-day average is certainly a metric that he could use. Looking at the cases is a metric he could use. Looking at the 7-day average is a metric he could use. But he needs to clarify that in his remarks.
All right. Well, are you ready to offer a ruling?
I'm ready if you are.
Let's hear it.
We rated this claim mostly true.
Mostly true. Congressman Lloyd Doggett's claim that Hayes County saw an 845% increase in COVID cases since June 7th. That rating from Madeline Meckelberg of PolitiFact, Texas. Madeline, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Joining us again with more of the Talk of Texas, social media editor Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are you seeing?
Hi, David. Well, as we've been talking about COVID-19 cases spiking across Texas, the big conversation on social media, we heard about the situation there in Corpus Christi earlier in the show. In Austin, the public health authority said at a meeting yesterday that they are on the verge of issuing another stay-at-home order as the capital city continues to serve as a hotbed for the virus. So continuing to hear from folks about the reopening and potential reclosure of some Texas cities. On our Facebook page, Christopher Bart says, "We rushed the opening and expanded it before we knew what was happening." He adds, "Reopening is going to have to come with a better enforcement of distancing and face coverings and a comprehensive public information campaign to show just how bad this is when it makes you sick." So obviously, you know, just in the thick of it right now, David. I believe mm-hmm. yesterday we saw Texas posting a new record, one which had been eclipsed previous records by, I think, yesterday's case count was 1,000 higher
wow.
than the previous record, if I have
Incredible.
That number right. So staggering stuff. You know, speaking of Austin, some news that broke while we were on the air here. The Austin City Limits Festival, ACL Fest, canceled. Perhaps not too surprising here.
Right.
But the festival organizers issuing a statement saying, "We would have loved to put on another memorable show this year. However, with the uncertainty surrounding the current situation in Texas, they call this decision the only responsible solution." And they add that they plan to return next year in 2021 for what would be the fest's 20th anniversary. So again, not terribly surprising, as no. some of our friends on Facebook note. Christy Cristal Casey Moore notes, "No surprise." And Jesse Klemecki Smith calls it a sad necessity and urges our fellow music lovers to stay safe, friends. And obviously the impact on live music and bars here in a city like Austin, which is known for both of those, it cannot be overstated.
Devastating,
on the local economy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here, yeah. Definitely.
You know, one of the nice things, however, I suppose you could call this a silver mm-hmm. lining, at least for music fans. It's been the large number of music streams that musicians have been providing, and then I've been enjoying those. I don't know if you've checked some of those out, but we have a list that usually comes on Fridays here on The Standard, and mm-hmm. you can go back over to texasstandard.org and check out a bit of what we're talking about here. But those have been really enjoyable, I have to say. And
they certainly
you feel
have.
Good about making contributions, too, to the musicians who are trying to get by in these extraordinary times.
That's true. And, you know, I've seen, you know, obviously streaming is a huge part of how so many people get their music. And I've noticed that even, you know, the big services like Spotify, now they have things like tip jars where you can donate directly to a band
yeah.
in addition, because honestly, they don't get a whole lot of money for the streaming royalties. So anything else you can do to sort of help those performers out, I'm sure they definitely appreciate it.
Absolutely. I hear that music. Don't you? Yeah, that means it's the end of the big broadcast, alas, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org 24/7. And of course, we're going to be back here on the radio tomorrow, and we hope you will join us then. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Muldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.